You're listening to Living Lab Radio. I'm Heather Goldstone. The CDC has tracked almost 700 cases of measles so far this year, and New York City officials have declared a health emergency. That's despite the fact that there is a readily available vaccine, and measles was officially declared eliminated from the U.S. almost 20 years ago. Meanwhile, an ongoing outbreak of Ebola in the Democratic Republic of Congo has infected more than 1,300 people and is already the second deadliest Ebola outbreak on record. That's despite the fact that researchers and officials fast-tracked vaccine development after the last outbreak, and 100,000 people have received the vaccine. Now, these numbers pale in comparison to the tens of millions of people killed by Spanish flu a century ago. We have made huge advances in preventing and treating infectious diseases since then. But clearly, we are still missing something when it comes to anticipating and responding to disease outbreaks. Those missing pieces are the subject of Mark Honigsbaum's new book, The Pandemic Century: 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. Honigsbaum is a medical historian and lecturer at City University London, and he joins me now on the line. Mark, welcome to the show.
Thank you for having me.
Mark, the numbers comparing the Spanish flu, I mean, it just dwarfs anything that we've seen recently. Clearly, we have gotten better at disease outbreaks, right?
Well, I mean, yes, I think that's true, generally speaking. So in 1918, when the Spanish flu swept the globe and it was a true global pandemic, we didn't have a vaccine against flu and we didn't have antibiotics. And there was really no epidemiological surveillance that alerted the world to the emergence of what we now know to have been a highly virulent strain of flu. So we're much better at all those things now. But I don't think we should necessarily be reassured by the fact that we have medical technologies that weren't available in 1918, because everything that scientists have discovered about the Spanish flu tells them this was an unusually virulent virus. And we might find that it's just as hard to contain it now as it was then.
Well, Mark Honigsbaum, in The Pandemic Century, you start with the Spanish flu and move on to a whole series of other outbreaks and pandemics: plague in Los Angeles in the 1920s, the Great Parrot Fever pandemic, the Philly Killer. I mean, some of these are things that I certainly never heard of, but you say that in each case, there are some commonalities. One is that they tended to break the rules of what we thought was possible or impossible. And afterward, there would be a lot of soul searching, a lot of trying to figure out what went wrong. Why was this so much more deadly than we expected? Why did it surprise us? And yet, time and time again, we're surprised again. What is it that we're missing? What is it we're not learning from each of these episodes?
Essentially, what we're not learning, or what we're forgetting each time, is that it's often our own behavior, the way we interact with animals who harbor something like 70% of these pathogens, or the way that we create environments either in hospitals or apartment buildings that allow bacteria to breed and colonize areas where they might have a chance of infecting humans. And the other aspect is that there's always a sort of wider ecological or environmental story behind each of these outbreaks. So the lesson really of these repeated epidemics and pandemics is that if you narrowly focus on the pathogen or the epidemiology of the disease and don't take sufficient time to understand the wider ecology, the interactions between people, microbes, and other animals in which those microbes might be harbored, you really miss a chance to understand the complexities of these epidemics. Scientists, not just scientists, anyone, can fall into the trap of thinking that once we have a certain amount of knowledge, we really understand how things work. We don't need to question it anymore. But the lessons of these epidemics is that as much as we've learned and as much as we know, there are always these unknowns out there, or these partial sort of understandings. And we only learn what we're missing when the next epidemic comes along.
To that point, I wonder if you could talk about how these blind spots to the ecological context have played out, particularly in the two recent Ebola outbreaks, both in 2014 to 2016 and now with another one ongoing.
So Ebola is interesting because actually, by the time of the outbreak in West Africa in 2014, scientists understood an awful lot about the Ebola virus. They knew that the Sudan Ebola virus was the most lethal and had been associated with most of the outbreaks, but all of those outbreaks had occurred in remote forested regions of Central Africa. So nobody thought or was really prepared for an outbreak of what was seen as a hemorrhagic virus confined to equatorial parts of Africa in West Africa, thousands of miles away from the previous outbreaks. So that's one thing. But the other thing is, and what we learned in 2014, is because of the different ecological but also social conditions in West Africa, the Ebola virus in 2014 behaved very differently from previous viruses. Mm. It didn't just burn itself out in the sort of rural area where it emerged, but it managed to find a way of getting to cities, to large urban areas. And then it did something else, which had kind of been raised as a sort of horror fantasy in books like The Hot Zone. It managed to get on an aeroplane, and suddenly there was big panic about this virus reaching the United States, something that most people thought was, well, highly unlikely, if not impossible.
Well, and here we are just a couple of years later, and researchers and officials put all of this effort into developing a vaccine that, by early accounts, seems to be remarkably effective against Ebola. They got that vaccine out to something like 100,000 people, and yet now we've got another outbreak. It looks like it could be almost as deadly as the last one. And on top of that, to your point about social context and how that plays out in outbreaks, we've got armed attacks on health and aid workers. How much of this do you think could or should have been anticipated?
To a certain extent, I think the World Health Organization and other responders had anticipated it to a degree, because they saw very similar distrust of health responders in Sierra Leone and Liberia and Guinea in 2014-2015. So in the wake of that experience, they realized that, you know, when you had an outbreak, it wasn't enough just to mobilize teams of contact tracers and health workers to vaccinate people. You actually had to go into communities, speak to traditional tribal leaders, chieftains, village headmen, and try and win the confidence and trust, and to really, you know, engage with the communities, but in a language that makes sense to them in terms of their own cultural beliefs, but also understanding of health and medicine. If I can make another point, though, so one of the themes of my book is hubris. Okay, so when I was writing the book, I was thinking mainly about illustrating the way that scientists often have a false sense of security. Perhaps you go as far as to say that sometimes we in the West, I'm talking about primarily, become complacent about some of these epidemic threats. What I never imagined was that when my book came out in 2019, we'd also be seeing outbreaks of measles in New York, other parts of the United States, across Europe, caused by people refusing to take a proven vaccine. So I think that we shouldn't be too critical of people in Democratic Republic of Congo who are no more distrustful of these technologies than many people in the West.
Right. Yeah. Mark Honigsbaum, in the pandemic century, another major theme is this idea of what are known knowns, known unknowns, and unknown unknowns, right? That there's kind of this unknowability and inevitability that comes from the fact that we are talking about living organisms that often change very rapidly. And it is, by definition, a completely random, unpredictable process. We can't know how a disease is going to mutate. It's part of what makes flu vaccines from year to year so hard. It may have played into why we underestimated Zika. So where does that fit into your understanding of how we should go about trying to predict or respond to these, and what our attitude should be toward these potential future outbreaks.
Yeah, well, thank you for bringing up Donald Rumsfeld's famous passing of the, you know, the theory of knowledge. I mean, most of the epidemics that I canvass in the book are examples of a fourth type of knowledge that Donald Rumsfeld omitted to mention in that famous press conference. And that's the category of a unknown known. So what do I mean by that? The Zika epidemic is a very good example. So we know, thanks to virology and molecular biology techniques, we now know quite a lot about these individual viruses. And in the case of Zika, the virus was first identified and isolated in 1947 in Uganda. Okay, so we had known about it for an awful long time. What we didn't know is that Zika could be associated with microcephaly, you know, these congenital neurological problems in young children. That was the unknown bit. And the other, there are multiple other unknowns about it. And a lot of those go to this question of taking on board or remembering the lessons of previous epidemics.
You know, I'm thinking about the fact that the World Health Organization last year actually added a new item to its list of pandemic threats.
Disease X. Yeah.
Right. Disease X. The known unknown, I guess, is what that would be, right?
No. Disease X is an unknown unknown.
We know that there's going to be something out there. We just don't know what it will be.
Yeah. I mean, but you're right. I mean, as soon as you give it a name, it's no longer, strictly speaking, unknown. It's a known, unknown, unknown, I suppose.
We could get into quite a tangle there. But I guess the point is that it seems inevitable that we know that there are other pandemic threats out there. We just don't know what they are yet. And that has fed two of the other themes of your book, panic and hysteria. And you say it has fed an attitude of hypervigilance that is in and of itself problematic. Where do we cross the line into too much awareness, too much vigilance against these diseases?
Right. So the mere fact that we can alert health responders to an outbreak of an obscure disease on the other side of the world, in and of itself, heightens our anxiety. So that's kind of one of the ironies, I suppose, or one of the paradoxes of having this technology, having all this knowledge. I'm not saying that because I think it's a bad thing that we have all those things. I suppose my argument really is much more that it's too easy to just blame, you know, the media, the press, for hyping something that turns out not to be as fearful as people thought. But the reason why the media reports things that way is they pick up those messages from health professionals, from scientists themselves. And often, because there are these gaps in our knowledge, and there is often a level of uncertainty, so it always comes back to this idea of how much we know and how much more there is to know.
That's medical historian Mark Honigsbaum. His new book is The Pandemic Century, 100 Years of Panic, Hysteria, and Hubris. Mark, thank you. I think I will try not to be too panicked about the unknown unknowns of the future.
Okay, thank you. Thank you for having me.